commencing countdown. T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Ignition.
What an incredible smell, you scum!
Dear Lord Jesus, this ain't happening, man. This can't be happening, man. This ain't happening.
Inconceivable!
Autobots, transform!
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode number 13.
Spanking the space monkey all the way to Arcturus.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Adam.
And you'll notice that Jen is not here today. That's because she has come down with some sort of terrible alien wasting disease and should be back next week, theoretically. But I guess it's a freaky coincidence this week because we're recording episode 13 on Friday the 13th.
Ooh.
Just kind of strange and a very bizarre coincidence. And I'm sure it amounts to nothing scientifically, but we'll leave that to the scientists to decide. So, welcome back, Adam.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Yes. We'll have you stick around for at least one episode. Maybe we'll get you back again when we do a special episode on space ninjas.
Oh, I'll be back. I'll at least be back for that when the Hugo results will come out.
Oh, and then we'll have you rant.
Well, only because Spar's going to win.
Oh, I'm surprised those haven't come out yet, but all right.
Hugo's are September, early September.
That seems like a long time to wait for that. But yeah, you know what? If that wins, you and I both will have a rant together. So
it won't be it'll be a different sort of rant because these are the fans that chose it, and I don't think it's a fan friendly piece.
Well, no, I don't know how anybody likes that one, but. Anyway, that's not the deal for the show this week, but we will bring you back for the Hugos.
I think Bride of Frankenstein might win by Mike Resnick, because Resnick's a great writer, and that's kind of... Homage pieces seem to be fan favorites.
And apparently Resnick knows about Africa, so you didn't hear that.
Resnick knows about Africa.
It's the whole the Norman Spinrad ordeal, where Norman Spinrad... said something about African fiction, or I can't remember what, but he pointed out that Resnick knows more about Africa than Octavia Butler or something like that. And people threw a fit, and it was kind of like, but when you looked at Resnick's history, like, even though he's a white guy, like, he spent considerable time in Africa. So, I mean, maybe he does know more about Africa than Octavia Butler. I don't know. I don't know enough about Octavia Butler to know for sure. But anyway, this week in news, some really sad news and some really happy news. So should we start with the sad news first?
I suppose.
Because then at least we can end on a sort of humorous note and maybe people won't be depressed.
If they're listening to the show, then they really don't have much hope for it anyway. It doesn't matter what order.
Yeah, well,
they've already conceded, you know, defeat.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll start with the sad. News comes down from Jeff Vandermeer that a Best American Fantasy series that he and his wife have edited and been a part of making happen in general, that it's coming to a close. They mentioned there's a whole number of reasons why, but the obvious one being that the sales just weren't where they needed to be. But this kind of really sucks because the series had its fourth issue coming out, which was co-edited by Larry Nolan of Off-Blog of the Fallen and Minister Faust, who's a Canadian, I think, science fiction fantasy writer. I think he does both. And they were working on the fourth book together, and now it's never going to come out. And other things, obviously, that were important about this is it kind of was a blend of the traditional and the sort of literary of short fantasy fiction, which I thought was really useful because it's not just giving you the same old fantasy stories over and over. It's also trying to suck in stuff from all sorts of different places that create that kind of dialogue, but now it's going away, and I don't think we have anything that's even remotely like this for fantasy.
No, we don't. I mean, you have the odd issue of Conjunctions that tries to do it.
Yeah.
And they usually do it horribly.
But that's not a best of series thing. This is like
Dedicated. It was, I mean, I haven't read it. because I actually had never heard of it. Just one of the reasons why it's going down, because no one else apparently hadn't heard of it. But yeah, whenever you see something, you know, novel and like that go down, it's sad. So hopefully something will come up to replace it. I mean, knowing the Vandermeers, something probably will.
Well, I mean, it's not like the Vandermeers are going to disappear. I mean, they both have like 4,000 projects in the works right now, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Prolific. But did you see Larry Nolan's release of the his tentative list of like 65 that he thought were worth considering?
I glanced at it.
Oh, it's really sort of a really fascinating list, because there's stuff from all the traditional magazines for fantasy, you know, FNSF and yada yada yada, all of the stuff we know of in the genre community. And then there are things from all sorts of very strange places, like the Cincinnati Review and literary magazines I didn't even know existed, just from all over the place. Like, he really just sucked in stuff from everywhere. And I bet you it would have been a really awesome issue when they put the final call out. But
yeah, apparently, like, the entire Clockwork Phoenix 2 anthology made it into his 65.
Yeah, he had issues narrowing it down because he thought the whole thing was quite good, which is good. That says something for them, because I trust his judgment in literature. Usually he and I very much agree on things. So,
well, I've been reading Clockwork Phoenix 3, and I can see why it would appeal to a certain crowd. That crowd's not me, unfortunately. So,
well, it's going to be missed, I'm sure, but from the people who had actually read it. And now that I know a bit more about it, I now want to get the three issues that are still out, which you can get at Amazon, by the way, if you want it or not. But maybe we should move on to something happy now.
Yes, that would probably be for the best. The oldest university on Earth is to be reborn.
Yay.
Yes, it's very cool. Nalanda University in India, which burned down right around the year 1200, 1193, by a Turkish general, because they weren't apparently keeping a copy of the Quran, they're going to rebuild it. It wasn't a little university. It had 10,000 students, 2,000 staff, and it was just, you know, a center for everything, for philosophy and math, language, even health. It was actually around for 600 years before it was destroyed. So that's dating back to, you know, the 6th century AD.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
It is quite cool.
Do they say, like, how is it, like, are they going to try to restore it to how it originally looked, or are they just building a new one on its site, or?
Well, I mean, they still have the ruins to build on, but I think they're just building new facilities on the site, because they say they're going to need something like $500 million to rebuild the university.
Oh my, $500 million for, wow.
Well, I mean, it makes sense when you think of the size of India. They're going to need a university big enough to take as many people are going to be applying. You know, they can't like build a university that can only take 200 people in India. That's like ridiculous. They need one that can take 100,000. So it makes sense, but yeah, they're needing quite a lot of money to rebuild the university and bring it back. I don't know how that's all going to work out, but it's a really cool idea that they're trying to bring it back, to remake this piece of history. So it's good news.
It's good news.
And it's cool history stuff. I mean, you know, it was burned down for, apparently they were, you know, like you said, because they didn't have a copy of the Quran. Like, that's what they are saying is the reason it got burned down. And I'm like, what a petty reason. Like, couldn't he have just said, like, could you put in the Quran, please?
Oh, of course.
Would that
not
have been so hard to ask, or could he have just waltzed in? He was a general. Like, he had clearly had the ability to burn it down, so he couldn't have just walked in and, like, held them up at sword point and said, you have to carry this in this library now?
It was probably just a cover, because being an illiterate general, he actually accidentally walked into the ladies' room, so he had to burn the whole thing down to cover it up. That's what happened. You heard it here first.
Yeah, we're remaking history. We're like Fox News of the genre community now. This is good.
Ooh, no, none of that. No political stuff. Not, you know, come on. I was nice enough to fill in, and now we're getting into this.
All right. Well, we'll move on so I don't make any more references to politics. Other good news is something that's near and dear to my heart, kind of, sort of. Well, because I care more about his father than I do necessarily about him, because I don't know enough about him, but
I bet you that makes him feel good, Sean.
But I own one of his novels.
He's been getting that his whole life, and you just have to remind him.
I'm sorry.
Bring back your father. We don't want you.
Well, I know. I actually really think it's good. I just have not read any of his books. So
okay.
Anyway,
move on.
Nick Sagan, obviously the son of late Carl Sagan, is being brought in to work with the Science Channel to bring in a new series of specials and all sorts of good stuff. Obviously, that's going to be on science. And this is cool because maybe we'll get some more good stuff, kind of like what his father produced, or not.
Maybe. I love the Science Channel. They can do no wrong in my eyes. I wish I could still afford them.
Yeah. But that's true. That's a good channel, and they got a lot of good stuff on there. And Nick Sagan, I mean, clearly, he's not a guy that's just kind of living in a vacuum. He's been an active writer in the fiction sense. I mean, he's written for TV and film and literature. He's worked on the Star Trek Next Gen, Star Trek Voyager. He's adapted novels by Orson Scott Card, Ursula K. Le Guin, and a bunch of others. And he actually written his own trilogy of novels called the Idlewild Trilogy, which I have not read, but I own the first book, and I've heard it's quite good. But I think the coolest thing about Nick Sagan is that his voice is actually on the Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 spacecrafts.
That's pretty cool.
He's on the little
gold
thing,
disc.
The disc that, yeah, his voice is on there, and he says, I think it's a like hello or welcome from the children of Earth or something, of planet Earth, something like that. I forget the exact thing. I listened to it earlier, but
that's goofy.
But it's him when he's like 7 or something, like when he's a little kid. So point is he's now working on a bunch of new series and specials for the Science Channel.
Good news.
I think it's good news because, you know, Carl Sagan's largely credited with making science fantastic during his day. Mm-hmm. So maybe his son can do a little bit more revitalizing that, because I think we could do with a bit more of the gosh wow of science.
The sense of wonder.
The sense of wonder of actual science, of showing people just the stuff that we know. And yeah, I don't know.
I hope so.
Yeah, but maybe you don't care so much about that.
Oh, I do. I do. I just don't have the channel. So.
Oh, well, I don't have the channel either. I'll watch it online. So.
I don't have any channel. I've been living off of Netflix.
University library DVD section for me.
Nice. Yeah, I went through our local library, so which most of it consists of cooking shows, because we have all female librarians in their late 50s-ish.
Okay, that makes sense. But, yeah. Anyway, so do you want to introduce our last bit of fantastic news?
Sure, why not? Radioactive wild boars increase in number in Germany because of Chernobyl.
Darn Russians.
They're Soviet Unioners.
Whatever, it's all the same.
Chernobyl's in the Ukraine, not Russia.
Yeah, but they were part of
the Soviet Union,
which is Russia.
Hey, so if Italy does something, it's like, dang Europeans.
Yep, exactly.
But anyway, the boars are reproducing at a crazy rate, and hunters can't use the meat because it's radioactive.
Yep.
And they're reimbursed for the bad meat, but and the payments have quadrupled since 2007, and the number of wild boars killed is going up crazy fast. Like in 2007 it was 287,000, and 2008-09, the 2008-09 season, not those 2 years, it was 650,000. So that's, you know, over double.
Yeah.
And the most interesting thing is that the boars are evil. Sean, what did you write here? Could you explain your evil salt?
I know. Okay, so a part of the news is well, first the cool thing is they're radioactive. So there are some mutations in the boars, although they still look like wild boars, but they're slightly mutated. But the extra cool thing is the hunters and people have figured out a way to make the meat to pass standards by, I guess, apparently making the boars eat something that's like salt or special salt that goes through their system and then comes out as radioactive poop and takes all of the radioactivity out of them. But I don't think it takes all of it out. I think it just takes enough out so that it's edible.
And then they gather it up and sell it to Iran to use in their nuclear facilities.
Probably.
See, I can get political too. Take
yeah.
that, Iran.
Yeah, suckers.
buying boar poop. It's not plutonium.
Even though the U.S. has detonated more nuclear weapons than any other country.
Only because we're awesome.
I guess that's one way of doing it.
Those mushroom clouds are pretty.
Yeah.
I have a YouTube playlist of just atomic explosions.
They're really pretty. Have you seen the video of the that shows where all of the nuclear explosions or various atomic and nuclear and hydrogen and all that stuff, where they have all occurred on the Earth?
No.
Okay. When you watch it, it goes literally like at rapid pace, showing you where each of them have occurred every single year. It goes year by year, right?
Yeah.
And it is insane. I cannot imagine how we even survive, because literally when you see the end of the map, it shows where all of the irradiated areas are. And there aren't actually a lot of places that have not been in some way affected by the radiation from all of these.
Double negative is a way worse offense than all those nuclear bombs. I'm sorry.
Shut up, jerk.
The Earth is big. We could take what we put at it. Well, we'll tell ourselves we can.
Yeah, but now we're getting radioactive boars in Germany that are mutating and spreading like wildfire, so...
And pretty soon we'll have, these Ukrainian superheroes from eating the boar meat, and everything will be fine again.
Somehow I don't think that's true.
Well, just wait and see.
Alrighty, guys, so we're gonna go to the Nazi music, and we will be back shortly with the main segment.
The Iron Curtain.
And we're back with our main segment today. Today we're talking about a question that I saw somewhere that I've forgotten, which is basically, should readers and writers read outside their typical genres? So, if writers writing just science fiction fantasy or readers just reading that, should they read outside of those genres? And that's what we're going to talk about. So, Adam, we're going to start with you. What are your thoughts? Do you think that readers should... or that writers should read outside their genres, yes or no?
Well, yeah, because you should never, limit yourself. Anytime you're saying, I'm only going to do this, then you're cutting out a huge swath of something else.
Mm-hmm.
And other genres aren't, or lack thereof, aren't completely worthless sometimes. I think that if you plan on being a certain type of writer, you should read a majority in your genre, but sometimes taking a step out can make you look at it a different way. And get a different perspective on it, which could help you.
That's true.
I think that you should. Yeah, I think you should. Every once in a while, at least.
Every once in a while. I'm a little bit indifferent.
Oh, you can't be indifferent. Just choose an answer and explain why.
All right, well, I don't think readers should, because I don't... because this brings me back to something that I think it was... What is his name? Fantasy Book Review, I think is the name of the blog.
Fantasy Book Critic?
No, it was a Fantasy Book Critic. It was like Fantasy Book Reviews.
So many.
I think
so
it's
close.
Jeff
together.
C. is the guy who runs it. In which he, I guess, got called out because he was just only reading like epic fantasy. And people had said that, well, maybe you should read outside your genre, because that'd be good for you. And I think it was Larry Nolan that called him out, but I can't remember.
Oh, yeah, I actually know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and you remember he got kind of upset. He said that, I don't want to read anything else. And this sort of ties in also with, should people be reading female authors if they only read male authors or predominantly male authors? It's kind of like all of that, like outside of your genre, outside of your comfort zones. And... I almost think like from a reader's perspective, I don't think it should matter what you read, just as long as you are reading what you enjoy. From a writer's perspective, I do think that you should read somewhat more broadly, even within genre. You should read more broadly within genre as a writer, just so you know what's going on, just so you can talk about the different things that are happening and bring some of that into your writing and know... because if you just read the same kind of stuff all the time and that's the kind of stuff that you write, well, that's great. But I think after a while, maybe that gets a little dull if you just write the same story over and over. Like, for example, you don't write the same stories over and over. I've read a lot of your stories now and they're all kind of go all over the place. And I imagine that in some respects it has to do with the fact that you don't read any one type of science fiction or one type of fantasy. You read somewhat broadly within genre, right?
Oh, I try to read as broadly as I can within genre. I'll just, like, for a whole month, I'll just pick a subgenre and buy a bunch of books and read those. So I've done that with space opera and new wave and military, and I've done that with a bunch of different subgenres, and just because I you know, I think it's interesting.
Right.
I like to read broadly within genre more than I like to read broadly, you know, outside of genre. There are certain authors that I'll read outside of genre, but I don't go looking outside of genre for a new author. But I'll definitely look within genre for a new author.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same, where I kind of bounce all over the place. I don't have a set kind of book that I like to read. Well, I mean, it has to be a good book, but beyond that, I mean, I don't stick with one genre. I kind of bounce around. But I really like dystopia, so I read a lot of dystopian science fiction, but that's just kind of what ends up coming to me. But I don't know where I was going with that, actually. There was a whole point I was going to make after that, and I completely forgot it.
I mean, all you're doing is sitting in your little hovel reading for fun, and you don't have anything else going on, then it doesn't matter what you read. If you're gonna try to run a general, like, review blog, then definitely you should read outside of genre. But if you're gonna do like a review blog that's just gonna do, you know, paranormal romance, then I don't think it really matters what else you read, because no one's gonna care about you anyway. But
yeah.
Writers should definitely. Even if you're only going to write one type of book your whole career, you should read elsewhere, because the tropes and themes and styles and forms people use in epic fantasy are way different than they use in, you know, in crime noir. And,
oh, absolutely.
And you can use other, you know, it's just when something is revolutionary, it's usually revolutionary because the writer has done something different.
Exactly.
For that certain subgenre. Even if it's been done 100 times before in a different genre, it's been done different for that genre.
Yeah, I kind of was thinking like China Mieville's work.
You know,
a lot of what you does, he takes a lot of the tropes of fantasy, and then he brings in all of this stuff. And he's clearly well-read. I mean,
oh,
I think it's fairly obvious he's well-read.
Incredible how much he's read.
Even Jeff Vandermeer is pretty freaking well-read. You look at the stuff.
He's more well-read than China Mieville.
I think that guy reads anything. Like, I think he's a ninja, like, with a reading ninja. He just has read everything. He's probably read every book in existence. Because that guy, Vandermeer, I swear, his blog, like, every month he'll post a thing of books he acquired. And they'll, like, be... There's no common theme. They're just all over the place of what kind of books they are. They're comics, and even within the comics, there'll be different kinds of comics. There'll be, like, the literary-ish comics, and then the straight fantasy sci-fi stuff, and then weird things from like Godzilla era Japan, and like just read everything.
And that's why his books are always nominated, and his stories are always nominated for awards, because he has this vast repertoire of knowledge to use and play upon.
Yeah, and it definitely shows, I think, in City of Saints and Mad Men. I think definitely some of that wide readership on his part shows in that, because you can see not necessarily specific texts that he's influenced by, but you can see that he's drawing from all sorts of spaces to produce this sort of fantasy novel, and it's really fascinating in that way. But I agree with you that writers, I think, need to be somewhat more well-read, and I do think you're right also that if you're going to run any sort of blog that says something like, you know, that it's a fantasy review blog, well, then you have to review more than just epic fantasy. You can't just read just the same kind of book all the time. You need to read other stuff. Otherwise, you're kind of misrepresenting what you're doing.
Even, like, within the same genre, like, you should read, you know, temporally different, you know, because, a lot, you know, you're always listening, like, as a writer, you're always here to read, you know, what's being published now, even though by the time you get your thing done, that trend will have passed. But, and so, like, a lot of the classics are forgotten, and they're classics for a reason. And they're actually, a lot of the, and if you, like, read the classics, you're going to figure out the tropes way faster than if you read the modern stuff, because everyone's trying to, you know, bend the tropes in the modern stuff. You need to find out where they came from before you can bend them.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of, depending on the genre, I don't think a lot of the tropes get bent very well.
Well, they don't get bent well, but people try to bend them.
So I think the problem, like, part of when I gave that paper on New Weird, part of what I learned about New Weird was that it's very much a response to the sort of enormous quantity of Tolkien derivative fantasy, because Mieville's work and even Jeff Vandermeer's stuff is completely different. It has the same level of detail as Tolkien, but it goes completely other directions with it, whereas most epic fantasy doesn't do that. It's sort of, it's very clearly almost all epic fantasies are in some way derivative of Tolkien-esque fantasy.
Yeah, you can argue that about a lot of things.
Well, do you think that there are aspects of science fiction which are quite clearly derivatives of specific forms of science fiction that preceded it?
Well, you can say that, you know, almost every, you know, old style space opera is a Doc Smith ripoff, and every new one is a Stephen Baxter, Alistair Reynolds ripoff. It's you can always distill something to its basic elements and call it derivative. It's the specifics that make things different in the first place.
That's true. I just think in terms of fantasy, because epic fantasy is one of the large subgenres, and within science fiction, the subgenres are not at the same. I just don't think like it's as identified by its subgenres as fantasy is.
Ah, I identify science fiction way more by its subgenres, but that's
just
because
crazy.
I read more science. I love science. I mean, I wanted to name the show Subgeneric for a reason. I love subgenres. I love them. I love all every. There's at least one story in every subgenre that I like, that I know of. I mean, some subgenres I haven't read yet. I haven't got around to it. Like Edisonade, because it's such a specific subgenre, or Afrocentrism. Just because there's not a lot of people writing Afrocentrism right now, or Afrofuturism, I mean.
Afrofuturism, but, yeah.
But I like subgenres. I like to you know, dip my toes in a little bit of everything.
All right, well, I'm going to put you to the test then, sir. Right now, on the spot. I'm going to name a subgenre, and you're going to name one book or short story that you really like.
Oh, dang. All right. my subgenres are different from your subgenres.
Well, I'm just going to give you the general categories. All right, so where to start? Ready? Space opera.
Space opera? Which space opera?
Old space opera.
Lensman. I love the Lensman series. That's just a ton of fun.
Okay. Then new space opera.
The Revelation space series, Neutronium Alchemists, you know, the big ones. They're good. They're very good. And pretty much anything that Paul McCauley writes.
Okay. All right.
Well, that's even different from like Reynolds' space opera, but it's still new space opera.
Okay. Cyberpunk.
Cyberpunk. I'm a big fan of Neuromancer and the Burning Chrome anthology. You know, Gibson's anthology.
Okay.
I think that it pretty much begins and ends with Gibson. Neil Asher and Gridlinked, and that he uses cyberpunk in a pretty darn cool way. Cyberpunk has become more of an integrated subgenre. I mean, you find cyberpunk elements in so many different stories now.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The genre as a self-contained element is dead, mostly, but it's been sucked up into everything else. So it's very good, actually. I think it's very good because it doesn't quite die. Everybody now sucks into it. So,
yeah,
all right, next one. Post-cyberpunk.
Oh, post-cyberpunk. You hit me with one of those.
Yep, because it's not well-defined. There was an anthology.
It's not well-defined at all. Well, it's just like trying to define new space opera. Post-cyberpunk is... I can't say any, because what other people claim is post-cyberpunk, I don't.
Well, just give me what you consider... A story you consider post-cyberpunk that you like.
A story that I consider post-cyberpunk.
Yeah, because it's not well-defined anyway. So even if we're... it doesn't really matter. I know what I would pick, but...
Well, what would you pick?
Spin State by Chris Moriarty.
I've heard of Spin State.
It is freaking awesome. And you like hard SF, right?
Oh, I know. I love hard SF. Neal Stephenson, he like stuff like The Diamond Age or Snow Crash.
I don't know if Snow Crash is post-cyberpunk, though.
It's on the edge of post-cyberpunk. The Diamond Age is definitely post-cyberpunk.
Okay, all right.
Because, I mean, have you read the Diamond Age?
I have not. My friend has... Jen, actually. I shouldn't say my friend. Jen has told me I must read it or I will die.
It's really cool. I mean, there's a weapon in it that shoots, like, little nanobots into your bloodstream, and then on a call, they all try to burst out of you at the same time.
That doesn't sound like fun.
Oh, it's fun. And a guy's trying to like dig them out before they can. It's cool.
But they're nanobots.
They're nanobots. Yeah, exactly. So he's hopped up on drugs.
Oh, that makes sense. All right, next subgenre. New wave.
New wave. Oh, I could go on and on.
Just pick
on,
one.
Well, new wave I like more in the short stories than the long form.
That's fine. Just pick a short story. Yeah.
Trying to think of which Ballardian short story. I love the Atrocity Exhibition. That's a really cool one.
All right. Atrocity Exhibition it is. All right. Let's see. Golden Age science fiction.
Now you've gotten me. What can't I pick? I'm not really that big of a fan of Asimov. I'm really not. I've tried, but I really like Starship Troopers.
Heinlein.
I think Heinlein is Golden Age. Heinlein, I am a huge fan of. I think he did a lot of different weird things, and Starship Troopers just hit all the right notes with me. And as especially as I read Starship Troopers and the Forever War at the same time, and they're so mm-hmm. different.
I like Forever War. That's a good one.
Forever War is really good. Would you call it Golden Age?
No, it was
almost like New Wave space opera.
Yeah, because when was that released? The 70s?
It was, I think, 69. It was late 60s.
Okay. Yeah, because that would be post-Golden Age.
No, 74. 74, but I think it was written in the 60s, or parts of it at least.
Yeah, it would be post... it would have been post-Golden Age. So it's not quite Golden Age. It is. I think it has more in tune with the soft sci-fi stuff of the 60s and 70s.
Than it has with the space opera stuff of the 50s and 40s.
Yeah, because it's not so much about the space opera elements and the hard SF elements, well, at least hard SF by the standards of the time, that those things are there, but they're not central to anything. What's central is the social aspect of the changing of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that
Very
seems
cool
to be
book.
Most important. It's awesome. Cool. I don't think that the guys trying to make the movie, I don't think they can do it.
They're trying to make a movie of...
Yeah,
Forever
they
War? You
just
can't.
Got the guy who for the writer. I can't remember the name of the writer, but there is a writer now for it.
Nah, they'll never be done. It'll be in limbo forever.
It'll suck. I just don't think you can translate it in one movie.
I just don't think you can translate it, because it's just going to end up, I can't even comment.
It'll be watered down, and I imagine they're going to change the ending just because that'll offend everybody, because there's gay people or whatever.
Nah.
Anyway, so Golden Age, you went with Starship Troopers?
Or actually, I don't much care for Asimov, but my favorite short story ever was written by Isaac Asimov. It's called The Last Question. It's about entropy. Entropy is my favorite subject in science fiction. So,
all right, pulp era.
Pulp era? Doesn't that go...
precedes Golden Age, so...
I used Doc Smith already.
Yep.
Pretty much anything written by Jack Williamson. I like Jack Williamson. He's got good stuff.
Was he in the 20s and 30s?
Yeah.
Okay.
He wrote for like 70 years.
Okay, just making sure. I couldn't remember when he started. All right, yeah, good. All right, New Weird.
New Weird, gotta go with Perdido Street Station.
All right, that's a good one.
You gotta go with that one. that made New Weird a legitimate genre.
This is true. All right, biopunk.
Biopunk. Paul DeFilippo's Ribofunk anthology.
Okay. Yeah.
Cool. Really, really cool.
It's a good choice. What else have I got? I'm sure I'm missing a bunch of subgenres, but I got most of the big ones, right?
Didn't go steampunk.
Oh, okay.
Which is weird, because I haven't read steampunk.
I've only read a little bit of steampunk, but not much.
Like, I tried to read Ghosts of Manhattan by George Mann, which is like a steampunk superhero story. And it just started to get so cliched that I couldn't do it.
Yeah, I've heard that's a lot of the issues with steampunk, at least with the readership. The people that read steampunk love it, but people who maybe are not as interested in the cliches are having issues with it because of the fact that it is very recycled.
I'm working on a steampunk story set in post-feudal Japan. Should be pretty fun.
Oh, that'll be fun. I've only ever written coal punk.
Coal punk. Yeah, coal punk and steampunk are very close.
Well, they're basically the same thing. It's just coal power, steam power. I mean, really, coal punk is just an excuse to have coal as a technology, but with fantasy elements. So
yeah,
basically, because that's all it is. It's set during the era of coal, but with fantasy. So there's rifles and yay. Anyway, I like coal punk. It's fun to write. You can do lots of dark stuff with it.
Is that a pun? We need the drum set.
No, that was not intentional. Anyway, I think I hit all the subgenres that...
And a lot of them, you know, are the ones that everyone says, but, you know, everyone says them for a reason. They're really good.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, well, so I think I hit all of those subgenres. This is interesting.
You didn't hit all of them. There
I
are a bunch
all of them. Yeah.
You didn't hit just, like, social sci-fi as a subgenre and...
I don't know if I would make that a... Well, I mean, you could say, like, what your favorite hard SF book is.
Yeah, I mean, the SF can be broken down into, like, two major categories.
Hard and soft.
Hard and soft, which is very convenient.
Yes.
Then you have
and
alternate
then
history in the middle.
Media tie-ins, of course.
Media tie-ins don't count as anything.
Yes, they do. They just don't fit very well.
Oh, Dying Earth science fiction, which I haven't read.
Oh, well, now we're getting, like, real specific, like, specific themes.
Mundane science fiction, which I haven't read, because it sounds stupid. No, military science fiction. There's so many. I love military science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
First Contact. I think I'd choose Contact, because that's a good book. Generation Ship stories. I like Robert Reed's Great Ship. I think that cycle of stories is really cool, because there are just... so many ideas in his Great Ship stories. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you could go on. I mean, on Twitter, I did an entire, like, every day I did a different Twitfic subgenre of science fiction and fantasy, so.
Well, that's fun.
It was a ton of fun, and it was really easy, because, you know, when you're getting into the hundreds upon hundreds of Twitfic stories, mm-hmm. you start to repeat yourself. You're like, dang it, did that again. Well, I mean, I'm at over 10,000 words going one Twitfic story at a time without serials.
That's impressive.
It is impressive.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so let's get back to the topic then. So clearly you're fairly broadly read within your genre. So since we just talked about, you know, whether we thought writers and readers should, and it seemed like we agreed that readers just read whatever the hell makes you happy, and writers should read more extensively.
Yeah, I mean, I should too. I don't hardly know anything about fantasy subgenres. That's what I'm doing now. I started Patrick Rothfuss's The Name of the Wind.
Ah.
And it actually started really good, but then my wife took it away and was reading it, so I just stopped. But he lives in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, repping the Midwest, which is, that's Woo. Actually not very far away from me. I mean, it's a few hours, but
just find out where
really
he lives
far.
And bug him.
Bug him.
Yeah.
Actually, Kristen Catherine Rush, who wrote Diving into the Wreck, is from Superior, which is where I live and am from. So that's pretty
fantastic.
Cool.
Well, I think Jeff Vandermeer lives in Florida. So
Florida.
Have that
Who'd ever want to live in Florida? Yeah, he lives in Jacksonville.
Does he? Oh.
Yeah.
Well, then he's real close to me. He's only like 40 miles away.
But, you know, who would actually want to live in Florida if they had a choice?
Jeff Vandermeer?
Mm.
I think he has a choice.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the point was to bring us back to the topic is, what kind of stuff do we read outside of genre? Since we are readers and then wannabe writers.
Mm-hmm.
You want
an answer?
Yes, I want an answer. What do you read outside of genre?
I don't read much. We were talking about this before. I like Thomas Pynchon, but that's because he's like a postmodernist writer, and postmodernism is pretty much genre,
yeah.
Especially in its sensibilities and style. Like, Kurt Vonnegut is a postmodernist writer as much as he is a science fiction writer. But I honestly can't think of many people. I just picked up Stephen Hall's The Raw Shark Texts, which is this pretty darn interesting formally. It's an a book, and it's you know, general fiction, but the form makes it almost genre. And they're making it into a movie, and I have no idea, because he'll just have like a page where the whole text on it is just all meta-philosophical and in the shape of a shark.
That's bizarre.
So it's really cool. I mean, I love stuff like that. I have an anthology, a little-known anthology from the early 1970s called Anti-Story, and it's all about exactly what it says it is, about, you know, responses to story in general. So I have, like, sections on metafiction and writing about the writer, and it reminds me of that, but they're making it into a movie, and I don't know how.
It'll be really bizarre.
Yeah, but that book is really darn cool, and it's not technically not in genre.
Okay.
I think.
And you obviously read at least nonfiction. You read some nonfiction,
oh,
right?
Oh, I read nonfiction daily. That's what gives me a ton of science fiction ideas.
Right, because you read a lot of science papers and things like that.
Yeah, if you don't read nonfiction, you can't call yourself a science fiction writer.
Well,
you can't. You'll be one of those social science fiction writers.
Well, I write social science fiction, and I still read nonfiction. And there's nothing wrong with social science fiction. It's important, too.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, well, if I discount school, because if we count school, then I read a heck of a lot that's outside of what I write.
Or I pretend to on my papers.
Yeah, I've been reading a lot of lit theory and philosophy lately, which is not nearly as interesting as I just made it sound, which wasn't very interesting. Well, some of it is. I really like some of it, but some of it is just really, really difficult to master, and I have a limit to my patience with understanding Heidegger and Hegel. So, which are names that I'm sure Adam knows, but maybe not a lot of our listeners do. Don't bother looking it up. It'll ruin your life. Possibly.
It really will.
No, I'm just kidding. There are a lot of good ideas. But I mean, I read some nonfiction. Like I've read some books on like evolution and stuff like that. But then I read nonfiction that's not necessarily science related. Like I read a book called The Man Who Loved Books Too Much, which is about this guy who that this journalist who lady journalist that went after this guy book thief who had stolen like $500,000 or some insane amount worth of rare books.
Nice.
And so she tried to figure out why he did it and like did all this hunting, and part of it is about the guy who was like the detective of the antique book dealers people. Like he's the guy that like created the warning system to look out for stolen books and like went after this guy trying to hunt him down because he kept stealing all sorts of stuff. And so it's all about that, which I thought was really fascinating because you learn about the antique book trade, which sounds really boring just if you're not into books as much as I am. But then when you read it and you realize like the kind of like how much people pay for some of the books that they get is insane. Oh, yeah. It's absolute bonkers wild. Like, I mean, you could feed 100 children in Africa for that amount of money for like a year.
If you have first editions, like first British editions of all, you know, four original Winnie the Pooh books in good condition, you can get 30,000 easy. I would know.
It's not bad.
I dabble in the antique book trade. I have first editions of Tarzan of the Apes, if anyone's out there.
I have first edition of Swiss Family Robinson.
Oh, but who cares about that? Swiss Family Robinson.
It's a good one. It's worth money, I'm sure. I haven't looked it up.
Well, nothing's really worth money in this economy. Political.
Cha-ching!
We should have like a beep like they do for when people say bad words on the television.
And it just beeps over your whole political message?
Yes. I don't want any of that.
I have beeps. I put tones because Jen curses a lot. So, no, I'm just kidding. I've actually been the one that's cursed the most. I've had to beep myself out. It's not fun.
She's not keeping it clean?
Well, we're keeping it mostly clean, but we've made a lot of pornography references.
See what happens when I leave? Goes right down the chute.
Well, it was already there. Somebody made the comment that our between segment music was pornographic, so.
Which is, you made it, so, you know.
I'm sorry, but I never heard any porno music like that, so.
You would know.
And I would know, and it would make it very interesting, wouldn't it? Yeah, anyway, moving back. So I do read some nonfiction, and I read some stuff that, well, it's really weird, because, like, I think we were talking off podcast about this. Like, we'll read things that are not published within our genres, thinking that they're maybe not those genres, but then you read them and then they are.
Yeah.
So Ray in Reverse, which is by the guy who did Big Fish, and it's a novel that, you know, I guess we would think it wouldn't be fantasy, but then it's fairly clearly fantasy because it starts with a guy who's in heaven in a support group for people who've just recently died and are trying to figure out their last words. The words that they said when they were dying. And his words were obviously not as good as he had hoped, and then he lives his life backwards. You learn about his life in reverse until you come back to heaven again.
Well, Big Fish, you know, it's kind of a fantasy book, you know, even if they're just, you know, stories or whatever, they're still like fantastic stories.
Right, it's kind of magical realist, you know, and that's kind of like the point. Now? Like, even though Ray in Reverse is not published as a fantasy novel, I read it and I realize it is genre. And then things like Amos Tutuola's The Pine Wine Drinkard. Palm Wine Drinkard. It's not published as fantasy or mythological or any sort of a fantastic genre. But when you read it, it is. It's full of all these crazy fantastic creatures, such as a creature of skull people that's just a skull and it rolls around and then it rents body parts to make itself look like a gentleman, and then it lures women back to its family and keeps them prisoner. Like, that's pretty darn fantastic.
But like, even like if you go into like as a movie reference, like I watched Lars and the Real Girl a few months ago, which is just a fantastically amazing movie. And I don't know if you know it or listeners don't, but it's about this guy who's kind of off, and he lives in the garage of his brother and sister-in-law, and he buys a life-size sex doll, and that's his girlfriend. And the whole thing is everyone else pretends that she also is real, because he's kind of off, and you know he's just the sweetest guy. But that, if you wrote that, I would almost call that, you know, science fiction, or because it's so, you know, outside of reality.
It is. That's very bizarre.
Oh, it's an amazing movie. I mean, they do it really. I didn't want to watch it because it just sounded kind of creepy. But it's really one of the sweetest love stories you'll see in a long time.
But with a blow up doll.
No, it's a life size replica made of all kinds of weird plastics.
That's even creepier.
Yeah, and she weighs like 120 pounds, and so people are lugging her around. It's a really good movie.
I'll have to see it then. Yeah, so I mean, like, it's almost seems like even when we try to go outside of our genres, we end up reading genre fiction unintentionally or intentionally, or watching genre fiction in the case of the movie there. So it seems like, I wonder how easy is it now to find non-genre, or at least non-sci-fi, non-fantasy, like very clearly, like just all of that is cut out of it. How easy is it to find that?
Like general lit?
Yeah, but I mean, but even when you go into the general lit section, like Ray in Reverse would be in the general lit section, but it's not really general literature. I mean, it's literary-ish, but it's still like a fantasy kind of.
So maybe like literature with a capital L?
Yeah, I guess we can go with that. Jerks.
I know, I hate it too, but and they you have to say with a capital L.
I just say literary fiction because it's whatever.
Well, like, what about, yeah, it's so hard to determine what is just straight up, because you have to go realism, and you have to go staunch realism then, because, yeah. I mean, even like, you know, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which is crazy popular right now, that's a thriller, you know, it's not general literature, it's a thriller, that's a genre.
Yeah.
I just don't know if
it's possible. I mean, I guess for us it would be possible to find stuff outside of science fiction and fantasy, but to find stuff that is non-genre. Because even stuff that I think, like, I was just now, I just thought a book by Nadine Gordimer called July's People. Well, it's actually science fiction. People don't read it as science fiction, but it's actually about stuff that didn't happen. But it was about the future that hadn't happened. It's very soft science fiction, because it's just about the end of apartheid, but in a way that didn't actually happen, and she wrote it before apartheid had ended.
Oh, that's weird.
It's sort of like a dystopia, which I guess you would say is not necessarily science fiction, but I would consider it sci-fi. But,
then you would be wrong.
Well, whatever. But the point is it is genre in a way, since it's not necessarily just general literature. I mean, that doesn't work. And then I think Alex Laguma, which was a book I was going to mention when we get to our reading or writing section, he wrote the oh, good Lord, what is the name of that book? In the Fog of Season's End. And I mentioned to you that it's written in a sort of pulpy, noirish style. Even though it's not a mystery, it's a fairly straight historical fiction novel. But even then, if it's just a historical fiction novel, then it's already a genre.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's almost like short of just very clear-cut, straight literature, like, I can't even imagine where I would read that. Just straight-up realist literature. I don't know if anybody writes that, that is getting published in a very noticeable way.
And probably not right now, because it's kind of the golden age of fantasy right now.
Yeah.
But I actually had a professor at one of the colleges I've been to who, like, his field was realism and, like, complete and utter realism. Like, he was telling us about a book he read where for 45 pages it was just about a couple who was going apartment shopping in just the most plain language. Just
sounds boring.
Yeah, it completely does. And so you can see how the class was. But
well, I guess that's, I mean, I don't know. I find that this is a very difficult thing for us to even talk about, since I don't think I, now that I think about all the stuff that I have read, nothing I've read is non-genre. There's no such, nothing I've read is straight, just general literature. Even the stuff I read for school, all of it is some way fits into a genre, most of which is historical fiction.
Well, like Hemingway or F. Scott Fitzgerald, they're non-genre.
Well, they would be, but I was forced to read only one of those in school, and I've never read Hemingway.
You've never read Hemingway? I actually kind of like Hemingway.
I've just never really been into Hemingway.
Which is weird, because I'm ashamed to admit I like Hemingway, being a genre fan. I mean, I'm not like a huge fan, but if I'm forced to read him for school, I'm like, oh, this is not going to be too bad. I mean, I don't know why they teach him in school.
Because he writes short sentences.
That, honestly, that's the only answer I've ever gotten. But
he was sort of revolutionary in his time, but not really.
He's the reason why if you say you're a writer, people think you're a drunk.
Yeah, probably. Although I did learn that Steinbeck, what was his first novel? Was it East of Eden? No, what's the other one?
Grapes of Wrath.
Was it Grapes of Wrath was his
That's
first
novel? That's the only Steinbeck novel I know.
I think it was one of the other ones, but apparently it was one of his other popular ones that it was actually really poorly received. The reason why they didn't like the book wasn't that it was a bad book. It was that it was so realistic about what was going on at the time in the poor class that people didn't want to deal with it, because it was like facing reality of like the really crappy conditions of the poor people at the time. So they didn't like it so much because it was a little dark.
Yeah. I don't like Steinbeck. He's boring.
I've never read Steinbeck. I just have his books in my collection.
Why? Actually, when I was moving my collection, I got rid of all of my like literary books because I didn't want them.
You should have sent them to me.
I didn't want them, you know, ruining my bookshelves.
Anyway, all right. So I think we've mined this as best we can.
And I think our listeners need to send in, you know, need to help us with what are their favorite non-genre work,
which we'll get to that in segment three with our question of the week. So
three,
woo, yeah, reading and writing. So we'll be right back after the music with our reading and writing section.
Mm-hmm.
Ba-da. Ba-da. And we're back with our reading and writing section, and hopefully this will be semi-quick. So I'm just going to start with you, Adam. What are you reading and what are you writing?
I'm nearly done with Dangerous Visions, which, you know, greatest SF anthology ever, and it truly is. I mean, if you want to know how to write idea-based science fiction, read Dangerous Visions. I started Hyperion by Dan Simmons because that, you know, everyone says that book is amazing.
Classic.
And I'm waiting to read The Name of the Wind until I get back. And I'm writing, I've been doing a lot of editing. I'm trying to write a fantasy because I'm not very good at it. A magic, you know, magic based fantasy, about magic based on pain, you know, I thought hard fantasy meant, you know, really strict magic systems, like science fiction's really strict scientific rules.
Yeah.
But apparently, like, according to the Wikipedia gods, hard fantasy is just fantasy with science fictional elements.
What?
But so, I know. I think I like my definition better. So I think, but that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to write, you know, magic based on pain, which is
fun. I would think hard fantasy would be sort of the gritty realism of, say, like, George R. R. Martin.
Nah. I like hard fantasy as the... Because, like, same with science fiction. Science fiction, even if you're basing on scientific principles, hard science fiction is hard science fiction because it rigidly adheres to those principles.
Oh, that makes sense, yeah.
So I think it makes sense for hard fantasy to have to rigidly adhere to its magic system, because if your fantasy has a magic system, that should be a main point because it's freaking magic, you know?
Yeah.
That's a big plot point. Even if only, like, three people in the whole world can do it, it's huge.
Yeah, that's true, that's true. I think I prefer your definition to the one that you gave me that they have for it.
I know, I'm awesome.
Yeah, and I don't really like it's fantasy with science fiction elements. It's not hard fantasy.
Like Robert Heinlein's Magic Inc. was one of the... I mean, it seems like it was almost like the urban fantasy before urban fantasy is what the hard fantasy is.
Ah, I see, I see. Well, that would make sense. All right, well, anything else that you're doing, or is that it?
I'm still trying to do my short story review every day for blogging, which is getting hard because both Lightspeed and Redstone, they're letting me down, especially Lightspeed. Come on, JJA. Come on. Put something put some revolutionary in there. What it really is I really dislike, even if they're good, I still dislike stories based on an author's established universe that, like, in print. I think it's just milking the cow. You're not going to win an award. You're not going to change the field with a story set in a universe that you've already sold 50,000 books in. And Lightspeed's publishing a lot of those types of stories.
Oh, well, that's lame.
I think it's lame. I don't think that's where science fiction should be.
All right, well, that's what you're doing then. All right, well, what I'm reading, I just finished Left Hand of God on yesterday, and I don't like it. I will be writing a positive review of that book because it doesn't deserve one. And now I am reading, I think it's The Prodigal Mage, the sequel to Karen Miller's Innocent and Awakened Mage series. It's the sequel, and I think it's Prodigal Mage. They left the book out of reach, so I can't check the title. I started that, and it's actually kind of like it. People have had mixed opinions of it, but her writing is what I remember it to be. I really like the character, the way the characters, the voices come through, and that's the one of the things I loved about the duology that precedes this, Innocent Mage and Awakened Mage, that just the way the characters speak out, like the great dialogue, and she managed to do this sort of accent with the main character's Asher, and he has a I want to say like this peasant accent, and writing accents in the dialogue is like almost impossible, but the way she did it was just perfect. And it just, yeah, so I really like her work. And so now I'm reading that. And I'm still reading Harmony by Project Ito, which is really actually quite good. And then for writing, I am working on two stories. The first is a science fiction story based on the concept that I think came out last year, which is that we might be able to intentionally make ourselves autistic. And I'm using this as a concept of like, well, if you could do that, then you could dedicate your mind as a sort of additional computing power for a ship computer. And that's what I'm using it for. So the main story, I think I mentioned that last week, so I won't mention anymore. And then the other story that I'm working on actually has an awesome title. Are you ready for this, Adam?
I'm waiting with bated breath. I know you and your titles.
It's the longest title I've ever come up with.
Oh, so it's like a Sanford title then.
It won't. No. It doesn't. It won't fit into a tweet.
It won't fit into a tweet. It's like Sinner Baker, Fabulous Priest, Redman, Blackman, Gentleman.
Even longer
Beast.
Than that.
Longer than that. Well, it better be memorable.
Yeah, I hope so. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the title is A Brief Account of the Aberwithy Minstrel Monks of New Timberfax During Her Majesty's War Against the Reinarch Legion in 114. Penned by Alistair Parshall of Begottenshire, Northeast Wellick, New Timberfax.
Oh, I have one that's... How many words is that?
Let's see. I can... how many words is the one you want to talk about?
47.
I think mine may be a little bit shorter, but I have lots of big words.
I have one called... I have one called Forces or Events Immediately Following an Altercation at Finnegan's Pub Where an Average Woman Named Bambi at approximately 3 a.m. on a Thursday morning in aforementioned pub's parking lot is recounted by a police report gathered from a canvas of 20 witnesses and reinterpreted for aesthetic purposes.
That's awesome.
And then the rest of the story are just bullet points of this guy killing this other guy.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah, so I'm the title is, I like that one.
Yeah, I'm having fun with this one. I'm actually writing it as a gift for a friend. Kinda. Yeah, but I may actually try to publish it too, but I'm writing it as a friend for her because she did something nice for me. And it's written as journal entries during the war.
Oh, and an epistolary story then.
It's an epistolary story because the story has
that.
And it has footnotes.
Footnotes. So footnotes they only use in Chicago style formatting.
Yeah, well, it's got footnotes.
Historical documents they use footnotes for.
Because I think it's a published version of the journals with annotations. And so I have footnotes, and I've made up entire species of trees and all sorts of stuff with actual scientific names.
I like that. And in Gridlinked, which I was talking about earlier, before every chapter is like just a little snippet from some book about something that's relevant in the chapter, which is very vague, but those are some of the most fun parts of the book. I love when people build up giant settings without telling anything about them, just that you know it's there.
Well, the footnotes are fairly extensive.
But which brings me to something I forgot to say is I just finished The Shadow of the Torturer by Gene Wolfe, which is the Woo! Most amazing science fiction book ever written, ever in everness.
I haven't read it, but I do own it.
You really do have to take a break from art afterward because it so rocks you to the core of what you think literature can do, especially science fiction.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost hard to call it science fiction because not just because of how unique it is. I've never read anything like it, and I don't know if I ever will. I don't want to keep reading the quadrilogy because I don't want it to be over.
Oh, okay. Well, I've heard it's really good. I have not read it yet, but it's definitely on my to-read list when I have time, which will probably be never because I'm going to die at 90 because they'll change the retirement age to 103 by the time I get up there. That's more politics, by the way.
Yeah, put the beeper over it.
Beep. Yeah. All right, so let's go to our question of the week, which is tied into our main segment, so it'll be fairly easy. And that is, what are your favorite books outside of your typical genres of reading? So if you were just a science fiction fantasy reader, what are the books that you enjoyed that are outside of those genres? You know, you can kind of fudge it because as we talked about in the previous segment, you know, stuff that is published as literature is often sort of magical realist. So we'll kind of give you a leeway. You can kind of pretend that that's just literature with a big L.
Well, you'll give them leeway. I won't. I'll come to their houses and make them choose.
Oh, okay, all right.
Give me general literature now, and I'm going to eat all the food in your fridge. I'm hungry. It's a long trip.
All right, so if you want to send us your answers, it's easy to do. All you need to do is you can send an email to skiffyandfanty@gmail.com. You can send a voicemail to 206-203-1686. Please send us a voicemail. We like voicemails. It's good times. Or you can leave a comment at HTTP double. Why did I say the HTTPs? What is wrong with me?
You grew up in the 90s.
Excuse me. It's skiffyandfanty.wordpress.com. Forget the HTTP. That's ridiculous. Or you can send us a message on Twitter, which I'm going to assume you know how to do that if you know what Twitter is. So it's twitter.com/skiffyandfanty. So those are the ways you can contact us. We'd love to hear from you. There are like more than three of you listening, so please say hello or I'll cry. And the next episode will be me crying for an hour. Yeah,
I'll tune into that one.
Alrighty, well, I think we're maybe done this week. Are we done?
We'll be done.
All right, well, we'll see you guys, or well, at least I will see you. I don't know whether or not Jen will be dead, in which case Adam may be back permanently. Or at least until I can find somebody to replace him, since he doesn't want to hang out with me anymore.
If Jen dies, I'll retake the skiffy position.
You can't take the skiffy position.
Well, I assume she's the skiffy position because you obviously are so fanty.
No, actually, she willingly took fanty. You need to be listening to the episodes. What's wrong with you?
They're like an hour and a half long.
We've actually got them down to about an hour 15, I think, was the longest when Jen joined.
Okay, next time I take a trip to Texas, I'll listen to the one episode of Skippy and Fanny show that'll fit in.
Okay. All right.
Hey, if you talk about things that are interesting, I'd tune in.
We had a lot of interesting stuff, but anyway.
Oh, I read the agenda. I read the agenda. I can't believe there's more than three people listening. The show sucks.
Thank you. All right,
Where's the Sophonauts? I wish they'd come back. They're way better than us.
Oh, thanks. I guess I'll see you guys next week. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Autobots, roll out!